Okay, it's September 3rd, 1988, and we have with us Tracious Klein. Do you want to say your name, Tracious? Full name?
Tracious Klein.
You're also going to have to speak up a little louder.
Tracious Klein, that's it.
Okay.
You'll be fans are blessed about it.
Want some soup?
No, thank you.
And where were you born?
I don't know where I was born. I honestly don't.
What does it say on your birth certificate?
It says, place of birth unknown. This isn't going to be easy, is it? my biological mother abandoned my brother and I when we were babies.
Okay.
And we were put into a children's home. And so they just give you little fake birth certificates and they don't know what hospital it's for.
All right. When were you born?
December 8th. Well, that's what it says on my fake birth certificate. That's the only fact I have to live by.
December 8th, 1966? Your fake birth certificate.
Well, in real life, this is never very easy to explain. I can never explain anything. It's, well, they give you a little slip of paper and they like make like a little birthday for you. So you can have a birthday instead of not having something. You know, they want you to feel like you have these little facts that you can base your life on. So I just tend to say, yeah, I'll believe that. Although I celebrate my belly button birthday and my sobriety birthday on the same day. Yeah, because it has more significance to me.
Okay, what's your permanent address?
My street address?
Yeah.
I live on West Taylor Street in Reno, Nevada.
What's the number?
446. 8959.
89509?
Mm-hmm. Not very permanent, though. I'm not going to probably be there much longer.
Okay. Now, as you know, I'm doing this book called Attic. And I have the photograph I just took of you on one page, and then, like, your story on the other page, along with about 50 other attics. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's going to be one page or two pages. A lot of people kind of talk a lot, and I don't know how to edit. But what I want you to do is talk about what you think is important about your life, what happened, some pain, some joy, your spiritual path today, why you're an addict, because maybe there would be hope, so other addicts reading this book might get some hope, and just some unique things about you, because it's hopefully going to be all a self-portrait about myself.
Mm-hmm.
That we suffer from the same disease and we have the same feelings. So let it rip. You got 90 minutes if you want to use 90 minutes.
I don't think I can use 90 minutes. I guess I'll start at the beginning, since starting at the beginning seems the easiest thing to do. I grew up in a very troubled home. I was put into a foster home with both alcoholic parents. It was a real turbulent and sort of disturbing childhood. We learned, you know, how to deal with our problems was blotting it out with chemicals and violence and running away. I don't like to say that I didn't have any other course to choose but to become an addict, but it seemed like in all the formative years, everything sort of leaned that way. When I was 11, I developed an autoimmune disease, and I was put on some pretty serious medication, and I became severely dependent on the medication, and I was like this perfectionist little kid, trying to do everything right and do everything perfectly and not wanting to accept the reality of my physical disease. So I started taking a lot of painkillers to sort of cope with like not having to look at the physical pain. And then later it became, not only was it taking care of the physical pain, but the emotional. everything, you know, all those feelings of like non-acceptance and stuff when you're that gangly age, you know, in junior high. And, you know, I was like constantly just popping pills at school. I was an 11-year-old brain popping pills at school. My disease progressed, and I was physically addicted to painkillers when I was like 12 years old. I skipped a couple of grades, deciding that was going to be the perfect thing to do because I was going to be like the star of the family, this brilliant person, which came to no avail. Because I got into high school, I started drinking, something I said I would never do because I never wanted to be like my parents. And drinking just got completely out of hand. I discovered that I was physically addicted to alcohol at the age of 14. I held it together as well as I could in school, but it just didn't work. And I was trying to be an honor student and an alcoholic at the same time. The two don't mix. When I was 15, through a course of events that were real uncontrollable at home, I decided to chase the bright lights in the city, and I like dropped out of school and gave up a rather brilliant sort of school career because I already knew that I was like in line for some great scholarships, and dropped out of school, went home, packed my bags, and went to San Francisco, and lived in San Francisco for a year on the streets, where I like learned everything there was to know about panhandling and eating out of garbage cans, finding out what it truly meant to be poverty stricken. You know, I thought that I had had it so hard, and I went to San Francisco and I thought that it could have happened a lot worse than that. At that time, I came into contact with some great drugs and the psychedelic era, and lived at what I thought at the time was peace. You know, I was living at peace with myself, but in reality, it was just sort of, I had like one set of clothes, a blanket, and I thought that this was going to be my existence. It was real sad. It was, at the time, I didn't think it was real sad, but it was real sad. There was some pretty heavy stuff going on in our squat, and I lost a lot of friends to the disease. At the time, I didn't realize it was the disease. I thought it was the scene, you know, the hardcore scene, the San Francisco hardcore scene, which was never much of a scene. I ended up coming back to Reno and sort of scamping around, and because Reno being the place that it is, it's a real easy place to make it no matter what you're doing. And got into a lot of real heavy methamphetamine, freebasing, intravenous drugs, and heroin, thinking that there was absolutely nothing wrong with my behavior, that it was just totally acceptable. That it was there, and why not use it? Because I had never been told, or I had never learned any reason why mind-altering drugs shouldn't be used and used in excess. I got in quite a bit of trouble with the law. I got busted for some major brown thefts and ended up on probation and a number of different sort of wrist-slapping little details. And I decided when I was 16 I wanted to go back to high school and get my life together because I was going to become like this person. I was like, at 16, I was going to clean up, I was going to quit drinking, I was going to quit drugs, and I decided I was going to go to this great university and become this great, wonderful doctor and save the world. And, you know, no fantasies of grandeur or anything like that. You know, I was just going to be like, you know, Madame Curie. I tried to get into high school. They called the police on me. They found out I was living outside of my parents' home, that I was a runaway, that, you know, this and that, and a thousand other things. And I got busted, and the police took me to my parents' house. My parents hadn't seen me for over a year, spoken to me. And so it was like a bad scene all around. And I had a nervous breakdown at the age of 16, and like found out what they meant by DTs. You know, I thought people were like mowing the lawn in my room and stuff. It was really wonderful. As soon as I got back on my feet, I left home again and just wandered around. And this story's getting really boring here. But
no, you're doing great. Okay.
I sort of wandered around. There's a space in my life for about 2 years that I have just about no recollection of whatsoever. From about 16 until 18, I know I was sort of doing this and that, and I was sort of here and there, but I just was full tilt into my disease. My life was living the disease. I was just living the drugs. It was just total desolation in all ways. I want to get onto my recovery part here. I guess I was about 18 when I met up with Mr. Wonderful, Mr. Right Now, and I liked him because he had like all the good drugs, and he had more than anybody else, so he was the obvious choice to be hooked up with. He enabled me in every possible way that another human being can enable another one. It was like I did everything just to get my supply, and it was like, you know, you better not do that, or you're not going to get your drugs, or you know, you better watch out, or I'm going to cut you off. And it was like I just completely prostituted myself to have a constant supply of drugs. Eventually it turned into like, you know, one of those little like things where you're with somebody for so long that you just start to think that you're in love with them and you want to marry them and stuff. And we were living together and planning to get married. And there was a night, it was June 29th, 1925, where I was going up clubbing up at Lake Tahoe, and we went up and we were drinking and just having a ball and doing all this stuff and just snorting a lot of coke and taking everything we could get our hands on. And I drove down from the lake in a total blackout. One of my friends said that I stopped by the side of the road, took off all my jewelry and threw it in the lake, which I don't remember, but I remember not having my jewelry the next day. But getting down to Reno about 8 o'clock in the morning and like snapping out of it all of a sudden, like waking up almost and looking at myself in the mirror and seeing this really awful, hideous sort of monster in the mirror, you know, like just all the little sort of social trappings of clothing and makeup and thinking that, you know, those moments of clarity, you know, where I had been thinking that I was a real person. And I looked in the mirror and I just like didn't see anything but just a shadow of something that could have been and was never gonna be. It was real early in the morning. It was like a Saturday morning, and I remember hearing like these kids playing outside of my bedroom window and running around and sort of being joyous and free the way children are, and then looking at myself and thinking, oh my God, you know, my life has been like an entire waste. I haven't done anything. And I just said, well, that's it. That is it. I can't do anything. I can't go anywhere. I can't. I just can't. I just was ready to just give up. And I took bottles and bottles and bottles of pills that had been around my house. I just grabbed everything I could get my hands on and like washed it down with like a fifth of tequila and said, well, this is it. It's checkout time. And drove over to an apartment that my boyfriend had been dealing drugs out of, because he didn't want to deal drugs out of our house. And he wasn't home, so I drove over there, and he very quickly realized that I was ODing on drugs. And this is like the man that supposedly loves me and that I supposedly love. And he said, well, you're not dying in my house, because I don't want the police coming around and asking me questions. And at that point, I was almost to the point of like being unconscious. And he took me and put me in my car and like turned on the engine and like left me there to die, which was exactly what would have happened had not a certain person, who I was later to find out was a member of Narcotics Anonymous, found me in the parking lot and driven me to the hospital. And I wandered into the hospital. At this point, I guess I was still walking, and like fell unconscious at the emergency desk. At which point I was jumped on by a team of medics, and I had like a total cardiac arrest, and my heart stopped, and you know, they were trying to pump my stomach and get my heart started and everything all at the same time. And, I was like clinically dead for a number of minutes, and they like jump started my heart, I guess, with like electric paddles. So I was real lucky, I guess, because I lived. I woke up, I was in a coma for a couple days. I woke up a couple days later and just totally in shock that I was like still alive, and with this wonderful man that I was involved with sitting next to my bed, just like living my life. At that point, a psychiatrist that I had been seeing came in and said, you have a choice. You can either go to treatment or be committed to treatment. And so I chose to go to treatment. And I went in and did my little thing, thinking I was going to go on vacation, and it was just going to be like a nice little country club type thing. Little did I know what was in store for me. I had absolutely no intention whatsoever of staying sober. I just wanted to escape. And I totally avoided getting involved at all for like my first 2 weeks of treatment. And I don't know, all of a sudden one day something just clicked in my head. It said, geez, you know what? You've like wasted your entire life. And maybe it's time to do something, change something, have a future. So I started getting serious. I started listening to things at meetings. I started hearing experience, strength, and hope. And decided that I was going to try to stay clean for a while. That I was going to try to make amends for some of my past. And did a lot of things that they tell you not to do, of course, because I had to find out myself. And really seriously started looking into where I had come from and why. What I was going to do now. I set a goal that I would stay clean for a year, not thinking that I would stay clean past a year, that I'd just stay clean for a year and everything was going to be cool, since I'd be rehabilitated. And at the end of the year, so many things had changed. I had actually gone out and for the first time gotten a real job. And I went from being this sniveling little sort of street broad to being an insurance executive, of all things. And that's where my little suit, so it's like one of the nice little keys that I like very well. And started doing things with my life, you know, started picking up the pieces, started figuring out where I'd been, and putting my head back together, dealing with the way I grew up, and the choices that I had made. And
at the end of the year, I decided, well, this year's been so good, I'll try for another year, because I can't do anything one day at a time. And tried for another year, and many things happened. I had like a lot of awakenings as to a lot of the reasons for my behaviors and the fact that I couldn't deal with life on life's terms, as they say. I started learning how to live in the world as a human being, as somebody that has feelings, as somebody that somebody that can actually think with my brain rather than a chemical doing my thinking for me. On my 3-year birthday this year, it was really wonderful. I was really in doubt as to whether I was going to stay clean or not, because of the fact that so many fucking things had happened in my life, and it seemed like everything was going down the drain. And I was starting to like feel a lot of those feelings of like desolation and loss and not dealing with stuff. And I always decide on the night of my birthday whether I'm going to stay clean another year. And I walked in, and I walked into this club. We were going out dancing, and I walked into this club, and there was like the band. There's a band playing, and the band starts singing "Happy Birthday" to me. And I keep walking, and I walk over to this corner where all my friends are from the program. And there's cakes, and flowers, and balloons, and everything. And it was like, just when you think everything is lost, you know, it seems that something new is around the corner, or something new to find. Sort of that. It's always darkest just before the dawn, because I got a feeling of what the hell am I thinking about using again when I have this much support and love and outpouring from the people in my life. How could I dare go out there and kill myself with drugs? Because I believe that were I to go back out and use again, it would just be like a complete rerun back to the day before I got sober. And the day before I got sober was the day I almost died. And so I know what's out there for me. I know that I don't have any using that. Anyways, I really don't know what else to say. My 3-year birthday was the 4th of July, which was about 2 months ago. And I've been hanging in there. It's been real hard. I'm having to kind of grovel and do some things that I'm not real happy with, because I have some difficulties with behaving myself and keeping jobs and stuff. I've one way of dealing with some of the stuff that has happened in my past and in my present is writing it down. And writing it down has gotten me to a point where I've got so many pages of work that I'm writing a book, and it's going to be like an autobiography. And I don't know how terribly interesting it's going to be, and I know it's not going to be terribly unique, but I'm hoping that maybe there's like one person out there that shares my story, that knows what it is to be an avant-garde addict, and an addict searching for some sort of timeless time, some sort of suspension in like the nothing, some sort of I don't know, spiritual outcast. But I'm having fun with this conversation. Everything's really new, and I don't know what else to say. I'm really glad that I'm at World Service. This is a great experience for me. And okay, and now I'm done. The end. And I won't kill myself till next week. My story's like so boring. It's so cut and dry. It's so.
You're all done, right?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.